Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast. This is number 942B, and we have an outstanding guest for you today. The B's are always the guest segment. The A, of course, is the news of the week, but especially what it means to you. And this subject that we're going to start talking to Professor Peter Pitts. He's a former FDA Associate Commissioner and President of the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest. He's going to discuss the measles epidemic with us. And he's a co-founder, by the way, of the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest, CMPI. Professor Pitts, thank you for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure, an honor.
So we've got now over 700 cases of measles diagnosed or documented in the United States, and I guess it's in 23 different states, and it's highly concentrated in some religious groups that didn't vaccinate their children. Is this going to, how long will this continue on, and will it eliminate the, quote, elimination of measles as a communicable disease in the United States?
Yeah, the return of measles really is the perfect storm of three things: vaccine denial, stupidity, and groupthink. You know, you mentioned that the measles outbreak is, in some respects, concentrated in some religious communities, and that's certainly true in New York. But I think it's important to say that the members of that community have been trying to educate these largely moms who, for some reason, don't think vaccinations are a good idea to get off their behinds and get the job done. You know, not getting your child vaccinated really is child abuse at the molecular level. And, you know, the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, has told these people if they don't get their kids vaccinated, there are going to be consequences. They'll be fined. Their kids can even be taken away. And they had the gall to sue the city. And fortunately, a judge said that the city has every right to do this because firefighters, for example, don't need permission to enter a burning building because it threatens other apartments and other apartment buildings. And that's exactly the way that measles works. When you don't vaccinate a child, you lose what's called the herd effect, H-E-R-D, which means that if every member of the herd isn't vaccinated, every member of the herd is at risk. And that's especially true for young children. Obviously, the consequences of getting measles is not simply wiping your nose and getting some bed rest. You can have serious lifelong impact issues. So I think as we move forward, public education has really got to step up to the plate. Vaccine denialism, the whole Andrew Wakefield autism link thing still is out there. We can't seem to kill it. And we need public education. We need to get it done. This is just too important not to pursue. Because when you allow measles, and then what comes next? Mumps, rubella, polio to come back? Pertussis is already back in California. This can't be allowed to happen.
So one of the issues is it, in other words, we can force kids to go to school to get vaccinated, except in some extreme emergency exceptions. But they've had a religious and some other exceptions up to now in many states. How common are the exceptions, and what percent of the kids have now been vaccinated against measles, mumps, and rubella, I guess is the common.
Sure. Yeah, I believe in civil rights and personal liberties, but I think you have to be pragmatic. You know, getting rid of these types of childhood diseases is just too crucial to pussyfoot around with exceptions. Clearly, there's always going to be an exception here or there that's legitimate and that you can rationalize. But at the end of the day, I think there are too many exceptions for too many children. And it basically allows people to think that vaccines simply aren't important anymore, and that if it's inconvenient or if they saw something on the internet that they don't like, they can avoid them. I think we've got to crack down on giving exceptions unless these situations really are quite outstanding. Be what we're doing, among other things, is sending the wrong message that if you don't want to get a vaccine, that's okay. Don't get a vaccine. That's not acceptable public health policy.
So when this started, let's go and if you will, I'm on the framework that you're in, that it should be as close to mandatory as possible And that although vaccines aren't perfectly safe, the benefit is 40,000 or 400,000 per vaccine, 40,000 to one for the 10 vaccines. I can tell you that Dr. Oz and I interviewed everyone on both sides of the issue way back in 2000 and I think 6 to 8, and wrote a chapter on it in a couple books, and offended everyone, and only the CDC will continue to talk to us, meaning on all sides of the issue, because we said, you know, blatantly, they weren't safe, but they're a hell of a lot better than any alternative. And so the question is, since there is even a minuscule amount of risk with them, can we force people to get them except if they've had an allergic reaction to a prior vaccine?
Well, I think we can. The question is, should we do that? And you know, it kind of boils down to, what does safe mean? I mean, there's no such thing as a drug or a vaccine that is 100% safe, not ever. I mean, there's no such thing as a street that's 100% safe to cross, or an apple that's 100% safe to eat. So there's always a degree of risk. But as you mentioned, the benefit of getting vaccinated so enormously outweighs any potential risk that it really should become close to a universal have to do. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, vaccines don't cause autism. You know, vaccines can cause other issues, as can drinking a glass of water. But the benefit both to the person getting vaccinated and to the community in which they live is so enormous that it comes as close to anything I could think of as something we need to really force our entire population to undertake, whether they want to or not.
And so the message, if you will, should be, these are strongly urged. And by strongly is essentially, unless you have a strong allergic reaction to it, you should be getting them. What percent now have it in other words, is this going to continue? What percent have what you might call herd immunity because they've been vaccinated, but what percent have gotten vaccinated now?
Well, I guess the point is that we at one point reached almost universal vaccination rates. But now that these diseases are coming back, and to your first question, I think that the fire is not yet burned out. It's still burning very hot, and it's got a long way to go, because obviously, you know, these diseases have been around for a long time. When you give them a foothold, Mother Nature usually always wins. So I think that we're going to see it increase for a while. And perhaps the only positive that comes out of this problem is that people begin to recognize the urgency of vaccines all over again.
And do you know what percent have been vaccinated? If you took all kids under the age of 10, what percent have been vaccinated against measles now?
I think when you're looking at the MMR, you're probably looking at 96, 97% vaccination rates. I think what you really begin to see, the problem isn't nationwide. It's in specific geographic pockets where you have communities that are fighting against vaccination. So I think if you took away the hot spots, you'd probably be close to 97, 98%.
And now, looking at the hot spots, with 97 or 98%, you'd expect to have a lot of herd immunity, but you don't with this. And why is that?
Well, firstly, because it's spreading within communities that have low vaccination rates. So it's unfortunately math as that goes. But then you also have children who have not yet been vaccinated within a herd community who are exposed, because people traveling through their communities, or airplane flights that they've taken, or the virus being able to last quite a long time, especially in warmer weather. And again, the numbers begin to accumulate. And also, I think on the good end, we're doing a much better job through technology capturing the data, so we can recognize these problems earlier than we otherwise might have.
And how much? So we've got, say, 3 or 4% that are unvaccinated. And if you figure 4 million kids a year, and I don't know if that's still the number, but if you figure 4 million kids a year, 3% unvaccinated, is 120,000. Is that right? Yes, 120,000 children. We're only at 700 now, having developed the disease. Where will it go? What's your prediction? Will this burn out before it gets to that big a number?
I don't think it will, because if you have a large amount of unvaccinated kids in concentrated geographic areas, you know, luck is not going to cut it. know, this is how epidemics start and how they continue, by continuing to give the virus the oxygen to find new bodies to inhabit. That's especially true when it comes to newborns.
Now, let's go to another subject, if I can. So I think the basic message is this can be a disabling disease. It is a serious disease. And before vaccination, we used to have kids dying from this and being disabled for life from this. So this is a serious problem.
And it's highly contagious.
So this is a serious problem. But and so both of us believe strongly in the benefit to risk. When we did the calculation, Dr. Oz and I, way back in 2000, and I think it was 6 to 8, it looked like it was a 40,000-to-1 ratio for, that is 40,000 times more benefit or more chance of preventing a serious problem than in causing one by getting the 10 childhood vaccines. Let's go and talk now, if I can go and flip to another subject that's dear to the heart of a lot of people, is drugs, that is medications from other countries, and the cost, and why the cost of medications is so high in the United States, for example, for compared to with Canada or France.
Right. Well, let's look at Canada first. Let's look at the question. So the question is, why are drugs so much more expensive in the U.S. than in Canada? Common question. And you have to break that down. The first thing you have to understand is that about 90% of all the medicines in the U.S. by volume are generic drugs, safe and effective, FDA approved. Generic drugs in the U.S. are less expensive, considerably less expensive than in Canada or Europe. So 80% of the volume of the drugs used in the U.S. are actually less expensive than drugs in Canada. People don't think about that. Now, the other reason drugs are less expensive in Canada is because Canadians pay significantly higher tax rates to cover, you know, federal and provincial health issues. And that's not an insignificant amount of money. Imagine if your taxes were increased 30% to cover your healthcare costs, how you would feel about that. You know, the other issue is that you really have a hard time comparing Canada and the U.S. Even though literally we're both very large geographic countries. We have about 370 million people. They've got about 40 million people. We're not the same country at all when it comes to numbers. And then lastly, when you have government-provided health care, whether it's in Canada or various European countries, you save money by rationing care, by telling patients what types of drugs they can get and what types of drugs they can't get. That's trade-off. And I think that if we're going to have that conversation, we need to have an honest conversation about the trade-offs rather than simply saying more expensive, less expensive. I guess, and lastly, the denominator of this conversation really shouldn't be price. It should be value. You know, what's the value that patients get from the various types of medicines their doctors recommend that they use? Price obviously is one of many above the line items, but if we only talk about price, you know, we're really missing, you know, a large part of the conversation. And I guess just one other thing I'd add is that, you know, during my years at the FDA, we did lots of studies and inspections of drugs crossing the border from Canada. Many of the drugs weren't actually from Canada; they were passing in through Canada. Other drugs were counterfeit. Some were expired. Some were super potent. Some were subpotent. You know, it's like my grandmother used to say, you know, sometimes a bargain is too expensive. You really want to know what's going on. And of course, if you can't afford the drugs that you take, there are lots of ways that can be dealt with, you know, within our borders. You know, we have what's called a closed regulatory system. So the drugs that are coming in from Canada are not FDA approved. They're not FDA inspected. There are lots of rhetorical finesses that some of these people try to use. But at the end of the day, you're not going to find out if a drug that you're using from Canada has been recalled. There's no really place you can go to make sure that they were properly refrigerated. There are all sorts of issues, which is why this has never really panned out to be a plausible solution. And, you know, the Congressional Budget Office has scored this financially and said that if we went to a full-time importation program, it would lower drug prices in this country by 0.01%. And that doesn't even take into consideration the money that would be spent to ramp up the FDA to become the drug regulatory agency for the U.S. and Canada. So, nice soundbite, doesn't really work in reality.
And let's talk a little bit about a lot of our drugs now seem to be imported. That is, a lot of the generics are made in other countries, and people question what's the quality of that versus those made in the United States.
That's a great question, a really important question. And the answer is that drugs that are made outside our borders that are legal for sale inside the U.S. are manufactured inside plants that are inspected regularly by the FDA. In other words, they make drugs that are up to FDA standards just outside of our national borders. And the FDA needs to do a good job, and I think they need to do a better job, because we've seen situations lately where active ingredient or excipients from some drugs manufactured in foreign countries are substandard. So, you know, vigilance is always required. But I think if you go to your pharmacy and you buy drugs that are manufactured in India or Ireland or elsewhere, if those drugs are being sold to you at a brick-and-mortar pharmacy, they're legal, they're safe and effective, and they're okay to use it because they have the FDA stamp of approval.
And when you say inspected regularly, one of the things that I think we learned with the recent Losartan reviews from, which is a recalled drug from China, is that we just don't have enough inspectors in many of these countries for as often regular reviews as we'd like. Is that true, or is that a misperception that I've gotten from the press?
No, I think that that's absolutely true. And to deal with that, what the FDA has done is they've gone to what's called a strategic-based inspection initiative, risk-based inspection, where they're going to focus their resources on those facilities that have had problems in the past. So it on the one hand, it incentivizes companies not to get to trouble in the first place, do the job right, do a high-quality job. And for those manufacturing facilities that are having problems, the FDA is going to be all over them like a bad suit. And I think that the companies that manufacture these products and want to sell them in the U.S. need to tell their vendors, either you do it 100% right or you're 100% out of business.
Gotcha. So what I want to do is thank you very much for coming on. For more information from you, people must be able to get to the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest website, which is http://cmpi.org. CMPI, Center for Medicine in the Public Interest .org. And you just Google cmpi.org and can get to Peter Pitts. Professor Pitts, thank you very much for enlightening us both about the importance of vaccination and, unfortunately, a pessimistic view of where measles will go this year. But hopefully by being so strongly positive, hopefully more people will get vaccinated, and also for talking to us about drug importation and the fact that the savings on, if we were allowed to import, the savings, although for some people, for individuals, might seem large, for the country would be relatively minuscule, I think would be the right way of saying it.
Well, thanks for having me on. A lot of good issues, and I hope your people, your listeners, everybody out there looks at our website and joins the battle.
Thank you very much. It's cmpi.org. Darian, thanks for great engineering, but especially for you, our listeners, 50,000 of you a week, can't be wrong. Thanks for downloading us and rating us commonly. Tell your friends about us. This has been 942B of the podcast. With Dr. Peter Pitts, this is Dr. Mike Roizen saying thanks very much for tuning in. We'll be back next week. Remember the A segment every week, the news of the week, and what it means to you so you can live at the top of your curve till very near the end.